Hello and welcome to DesignAway, a podcast focusing on personal stories of designers who are living and working outside of their comfort zones. In this episode, Jorn and me will interview Thomas Logerij, strategy director at the WeRU Digital Design Agency in Amsterdam. Design has taken Thomas from Italy to Australia and finally, or at least at the moment, to the Netherlands. You will follow the evolution, or the graduation as he calls it, of his career starting from his web designer days, all the way through becoming a UX designer in Bugaboo and Booking, and a strategist at the WeRU agency. Besides this, we will talk about diversity, education, and basketball. This interview was recorded remotely from a socially safe distance in November 2020. Welcome to DesignAway, Thomas. I'm so happy to have you here. A little bit sad, to be honest, to see you over Zoom because I'm used to seeing you over beers and basketball. But yeah, we will have to do with this. And yeah, I know you quite well over those beers and basketball. But how would you introduce yourself to somebody who doesn't know you at all? Let's imagine one setting. Again, basketball. Why not? How do you introduce yourself at basketball?
Australian, I think it's certainly when you live in Amsterdam, where you come from tends to be one of the first things that you mention. So Australian, who I am, and I guess what I do is typically digital strategist and product design lead. And that usually confuses the hell out of people. If you say design lead, they kind of sort of get it. If you say digital strategist, their heads explode a little bit and they just don't ask any more questions.
How do you simplify it, or do you like it like that?
I kind of like it like that. Anyone who is a digital strategist knows the magic in being a digital strategist is no one knows what the hell you do. Therefore, you can do whatever the hell you want. Usually.
Nice. And what about the Australian part? You just use that one word, Australian. What does it mean? How can you expand on that?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be an Australian?
Yeah. In my case, it just means that's where my accent's from for the most part. But I mean, born there, you know, lived there over half my life and still have friends and family there. But yeah, that's about the extent of being Australian for me at this point. Everything else in my life is not in Australia. Certainly the biggest parts of it at this stage are not.
Yeah. Thanks for the introduction. Yeah. So yeah, we are usually going through time in this podcast. So we're like the ghost of your UX life, your UX past. And we start off with the past, actually. You touched upon, yeah, born in Australia. Can you tell us a bit about your time there? Maybe not the baby years and adolescent years, but your starts in design. What made you a designer?
Okay, I'll give you the short answer because the long answer gets quite boring, but I studied law in Australia. I did very well in high school, but I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And my experience at that time, especially in the late 90s, is most people that were in my shoes ended up doing something like medicine or law. I knew sure as hell I didn't want to be a doctor. So I became, or thought I'd become a lawyer. Didn't work out. It did a few years of it, but just didn't love it. Didn't have heart for it. And I ended up actually just getting a job in insurance and became sort of a manager in insurance. Only did that for about a year and a bit. But I met a wonderful woman in Italy. She lived in Italy and she lived in Australia with me for a few years and a couple, about two. And we decided to move to Italy, which is a fresh start. If you're going to do that, it's really a fresh start for you. And you can be who you want to be and you can do what you want to do. And I looked at it and I said, okay, I don't speak the language and I don't have any transferable skills. What's something universal that I can do? I always loved web design. This is in the mid 2000s now. So that's what it was back then. You were a web designer or a webmaster. And I basically moved there. My wife worked. She obviously spoke Italian. And for 6 months I sat in, well, I guess the first thing I did when I moved there was jump on Pirate Bay and pirated lynda.com trainings.
And I can relate. Yeah.
Yeah. You did something similar?
Guilty of the crime as well. Yeah. Lynda.com. Yeah.
Oh man. But I did pay it back. I did become a subscriber. So once I made money, I became a subscriber. But yeah, pirated lynda.com videos, specifically Photoshop, fireworks, and HTML and CSS videos at the time. And I even got into some funky stuff like, you know, Cold Fusion and MySQL. I think it was MySQL, but things that I didn't know anything about technology. So I was just watching whatever. And I didn't use those things at the time, but they have benefited me.
So no classical education. It was all self-taught and watching videos and tutorials and stuff like that.
I didn't even enter a proper tech environment until about 3 or 4 years later, something like that. And it was just like, yeah, it was like a kid in a candy store, you know, you loved it so much. You loved technology and you'd been doing it for a few years, but you'd never actually been around other people like you. And suddenly there were nothing but people like you. Mm-hmm. It was super exciting.
And how was it then in Italy? You said you didn't speak the language. Mm-hmm. You started from fresh. You started educating yourself. How did you make that into a career or start a business?
Yeah, good question. Good question. I was lucky. My brother-in-law, who lived and still lives in Italy, he worked in television. And television is not technology, but they use a lot of technology. And he knew enough people that he could get me my first two clients, I think, and basically told them I was a web designer, even though I'd never been a web designer, never done an official paid website. But the magic of that is that, you know, they say fake it till you make it. I don't like that because it's quite, I think, deceptive. But the magic of that is that once you do your first thing, then you are what you said you are. Mm-hmm. So once I did that first website, I actually was a web designer and it was certified. You know, I had my first portfolio piece and the second one was easier. And then everyone after that came very easily.
Mm-hmm. So not having a diploma on any of this, was it ever a problem for you?
No, never. You know, how many jobs I've seen over the last, what is it now, 15 odd years, they have these minimum requirements, need a bachelor of something, something. I completely gloss over them and it's never been a problem. I've never once been asked for it. And on the flip side, I mean, certainly like where I'm working now, when I joined, I worked closely with the recruiter, did a lot of recruitment. And I actually, together, we removed that requirement from our job listings because it was just absurd. It was absurd that people even ask for that.
Wow, that's a really good move by you guys. And I think more and more hiring managers should follow. I agree with that. And you mentioned another thing which can be seen as a barrier, and that was the language. How did you manage around that in Italy? You didn't know a single word when you got there?
No, seriously, didn't know any. Went to night school a couple of days a week and nothing but Italian TV. And it's not like Amsterdam where everyone here speaks English. So you don't actually have to learn the language. There it was the exact opposite. You know, it's sink or swim. So if you want to live there, you kind of have to learn the language. And I did. It took some time. But I also had my brother-in-law, for example, those first few clients, he would come with me and he would translate. And there's kind of a mystique about it because they would look at you and they would think that maybe you're better than you actually are. And they couldn't ask too many questions. So they assume that this Australian guy who says he's a web designer must be really bloody good, you know?
The expert from abroad, basically.
Oh, yeah, totally. We're getting someone international to do this. Oh, I'm going to tell my friends.
The best designer from Australia just came to work in Italy, basically.
Yeah, well, I could have pitched them. I didn't, but I probably should have pitched them like that, yeah.
So it was actually a double being out of your comfort zone. You weren't in your own country and you were also not really in your own area of expertise yet, right?
Yep. All of that. But, you know, it was also the period, as a result of what you just said, it was the period of greatest growth, I think, in my life. I've never grown more than I did in those 5 or so years.
So you saw it as an opportunity or as a challenge?
Well, I guess both. I mean, a challenge is an opportunity, right? It was both.
Yeah.
And what about your decision then to go back home after that? Was it a personal, was it a work opportunity that came through or something else?
We had a kid and I was literally sitting there one day staring at him thinking, you know, where do I want to raise him? Do I want to raise him in this sort of a lifestyle and environment, which was okay? Or do I want him to have a you know, big backyard and pets and, you know, well, not pets in an apartment, but pets in a yard to play with? And for whatever reason, I chose the latter. That was sort of a mistake. We did move back. I ended up working in a place that was a digital agency there, still around, that transformed me forever culturally as a designer. It really transformed me forever. So there was a big plus there, but everything else in life was a bit of a fail with that move.
Mm-hmm. What was the transformation that you're referring to?
You know, people talk about design thinking. It before that, I was a guy who loved design and loved to make things pretty. And I kind of understood the idea of usability, but design thinking is something else. You know, it was a systematic way of thinking about things, a systematic way of approaching your work and the world. And the guy that I worked with in that agency, the director there, he really opened my eyes to a different mentality. And once your eyes get open to that way of thinking, there's no going back. There's really no going back.
Cool. So you got something out of it. You say it was a mistake, maybe in some regards, but in another regard, you got something out of it, and it's something really valuable. So.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, you know, I mean, there was a lot of suffering going back, a lot of hard times. I think it was very difficult. I think I'd adapted to being away, but yeah, as you said, the payoff was, I didn't see it at the time, but I see it now. The payoff was huge. Yeah.
But it didn't last forever going back to Australia, right? So
no, it was
the next opportunity. Yeah. Next opportunity knocked on the door, and that was Amsterdam.
Yeah. So, okay, you're in Australia for this year and a half, and one day you find out that Australians can very easily get a work visa for Germany. So my wife and I excitedly kind of left the country, went back to our tiny apartment in Italy, and I started applying for jobs like a madman in Germany before my 3-month holiday visa ran out. And, you know, I had a couple of bites, interviewed with Zalando, for example, in Berlin, and spent some time in Munich as well, looking around and getting a feel for the place. And then kind of in desperation, I'd seen this company booking.com, which I didn't really know, pass by my job searches a couple of times. And one day towards the end of my tenure, that 3 months, that, you know, the visa starting to run out, probably about 2 months into that visa, I saw it again. And just, I don't know, intuitively, I said, oh, Amsterdam, I never thought of Amsterdam. I didn't know anything about the place, but I thought, you know, oh, why not give it a try? It worked out.
What was the initial reason to go back to, or wanting a work visa for Germany? So moving away from Australia again, what was the reasoning behind that?
Europe, man. Europe. just like Europe, you know, it's a very intriguing place with so much diversity and culture. And you know, it's Australia just didn't, you know, nothing against Australia, but you know, some places just feel more like home.
I'm curious, Thomas, you said you never knew anything about Amsterdam, and most probably your interview with Booking was the first time you stepped on Amsterdam's soil.
No, I'd come for 2 days before that, but it was, you know, very, very, very touristy. Like, I didn't even realize that everyone here spoke English. I thought I'd have to move here and learn a new language again.
was it a relief that you didn't need to?
So I'd moved here, and I think my first or second day here, I went into a T-Mobile because I obviously needed a SIM card. And I walked into a T-Mobile, and I hadn't really gone into any shops or spoken to anyone yet. And there's this blonde woman behind the counter, and I, you know, approached her, and I said, kind of paused, and I looked at her. I'm used to Italy. And I said, do you speak English? And she gave me this like death look. and keep in mind, she's Dutch, so very direct. So she gave me this death look, and she said, listen, never ask a Dutch person if they speak English. And it was just an awakening. I went, shit, really? And then we had a chat about it. And I never even realized. I really never realized.
Have you learned the Dutch language in the meantime? Or
yeah, man. Yeah, enough to get my inburgering certificate.
Okay.
My integration certificate. Yeah, enough. I work in a Dutch company, and I attend a lot of Dutch meetings, which I understand very little, but I'm around it. Yep.
Okay.
Compliments for the effort. Yeah.
I'm
still a bit behind than you. So yeah, I should step my Dutch game up. Thomas, I'm curious about Booking. It was your first Dutch company, your first experience with working with Dutch people, even though Booking is quite international. So maybe you can expand a little bit on that first Dutch experience.
Yeah, it's not that much of a Dutch company. I thought it might have been at the time. I've since worked in two actual Dutch companies, and the one I'm in now is really a Dutch company. It's an agency, like really a Dutch company, and it's not that Dutch, honestly. It's about, when I was there at least, it was about 30% Dutch, and the rest were internationals. But what I can say about Booking, I mean, a lot of ups and downs there, like really a lot of ups and downs, but it did teach me, you know, there's a whole thing that comes out of the valley, which is a very, I think, democratic culture, and I'd mean that in a political sense, around diversity and the importance of diversity and power of diversity. I never really bought into it because I don't buy into political kind of political, we push kind of political agendas, and it always felt like that. Ooh, someone at the door. And basically what it taught me working there, where you had so like 100 and something nationalities, was that diversity actually matters, and it actually does impact the thing that you're working on, the product that you're working on. But also on the flip side, right? So if a whole bunch of diverse people work on a product and the product is the result of those people, I kind of looked at it backwards. I said, well, our lives are also a product of the diversity of the way we live and the things that we do and the things we put into our own lives, right? Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, I'm also a product of the diversity that I've experienced, the diversity of living in Australia and Italy and now the Netherlands, the things I've seen and done, as with other people as well. So I think working there provided a lot of, I think, both professional and personal insight into the power of diversity.
Did it also help you to get settled in the country quicker, if you're surrounded by more like-minded people or people in the same situation?
So yes, 100% yes. But it also, over the long term, I think hurts you. And I'll give you an example. So short term, yes, you integrate very quickly. You settle in very quickly. You easily get the language. You can walk into the shops and talk to people, as the example I gave. And that's nice. But over the long term, like today, I've been here almost 6 years. It actually hurts you, because now what you have is a barrier around you that stops you integrating properly with the broader culture, right? Yeah. So where I live, not in, but near Amsterdam, you know, I kind of feel restricted to living here because I'm surrounded by people who are other expats, people like me. And if I wanted to move out to more the country and kind of live in a purely Dutch village, for example, I'm very restricted in doing that. I have to go through a whole adaptation process again. So it actually, I think long term, it hurts you. So, you know,
so it's kind of like the comfort zone, the bubble, I would say, a bit, that protects you. And yeah, after that, you joined, you said, purely Dutch companies, Bugaboo, and then Virtual Affairs, was it? Which
We Are You, you know. Yep.
Yeah, We Are You Now. Yeah.
Yep.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? Was it a little bit of a step out of the comfort zone?
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. To me, I was just going to another company to do, you know, design basically. And Bugaboo, all of a sudden you start, because booking, you didn't hear any Dutch, like almost none. And, you know, Bugaboo, suddenly you start to hear Dutch conversations around the office, and you know, you start to see things a little bit differently and experience actual Dutch people in a real kind of more Dutch orientated culture. And obviously now where I am now, it's extremely, you know, Dutch culture and powerfully so. And you know, there's a difference there. There's a difference, but it's, you know, thankfully it's a good difference. You know, I thoroughly enjoy Dutch culture.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the positive sides, but also on the negative sides, if you like?
Were there big culture shocks, for instance, in the working culture mostly?
No big culture shocks in the working culture, honestly. I found the Dutch to be quite relaxed in the workplace and very direct, which I appreciate because I'm also very direct, and I really managed to fit right in. I had more shocks working in Italy, more cultural shocks working in Italy, mm-hmm. in the office where, you know, sometimes people would literally yell at each other. I mean, we had a couple of people that would actually yell at each other, and I would sit there like, oh my God, like if that was Australia or something, it would, you know, basically you'd be down to HR, but there it was, you know, people would yell and then they would just get on with it. And that was it. So it was definitely a bigger cultural shock than that. No, here it's really fine. I find the directness nice, and I find the people to be relatively honest and kind and pretty laid back, pretty laid back.
And Thomas, I'm curious about one thing. You grew from web designer, mostly concerned about the visual appearance of things. You said you wanted to make cool stuff, to now digital strategist and product design lead. How do you see what's next for you?
Yeah, I simply don't know, man. I simply don't know. I mean, times have changed, right? And I also think it's a sign of the times. I know when I started, and probably when you started as well, Philippe, we would start with doing a lot of visual design. And you know, it was, you were kind of thinking around colors and how pretty something looks. And then you would kind of graduate to, well, when UX started to become a thing anyway, but you're thinking, I think more than anything, graduated to UX and user experience, mm-hmm. and how people actually use things. And then you started to learn about research. Research started to become even more of a thing. And then you started to learn around research, and you built this kind of full spectrum of skills in design. And now in my mind, I've graduated to digital strategy, which is even more systematic thinking. And we're kind of taking design thinking and applying it to business and having a lot of meetings at that really, you know, director and sometimes executive level with people and applying design thinking to their business and helping come out with actual original and creative solutions to business problems. So it's not about visual stuff. It's not about usability. It's really about business. What comes after that? I actually don't know. This wasn't a planned path. It kind of evolved that way. And I also don't know what happens with people these days that come in. I mean, as you guys do, I interview a lot of people, a lot of younger designers, and you have people coming in who, you know, they're really bad at visual design. They just don't want to do it. And they really just want to focus on UX, for example, or you know, someone who just wants to do research and they don't have a plan to actually grow and learn full spectrum design. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. There's no linear path for any of this anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that, Thomas. Yeah.
How has the current pandemic impacted your day-to-day work?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. If you are at the operational level and you're doing wireframes or, you know, effectively working with pixels, however you want to word it, it shouldn't have that much of an impact on you. You should still be able to have your meetings. You should still be able to do your work and produce. Even if you're at the design kind of managerial level, maybe you're a design lead or something like that, you should still be able to overlook, you know, oversee people's work and get involved and kind of help people grow and do things like that. My work is a lot of meetings and a lot of talking and a lot of workshops, a lot of service design and engaging people digitally. Yes, I can still use Miro and I do still use Miro to do a lot of service design and help solve business problems that way, but it's, the engagement is not there. The ability to feel a room's energy and connect with people while you're doing so is just not the same. And you have to really do it instead of being able to lock people in a room for 6 hours or 8 hours and or maybe more if you're doing, say, a design sprint. You kind of have to break it down to 1 or 2 hours so that you can keep focus and stop people, you know, pretending to be on the call with you while they're actually checking email and stuff like that. So it's had a huge impact. Neither myself nor my, you know, brilliant strategy colleagues have really cracked how to do it properly yet. We're still learning.
What about research, Thomas? How do you handle that in these days and times?
Yeah, I don't. Basically, obviously desk research doesn't really get impacted. It's exactly the same thing. But when you're talking about interviewing and speaking to people, we lean a lot more on the clients to help source interviewees. And we have a really wonderful researcher in our Rotterdam office, and she's extremely good with remote research. So she helps a lot with the interviews, but actually sourcing the people, we tend to rely on the clients a lot, obviously with our help and support and guidance. But they tend to have more direct contact with the kind of people we need to interview. But of course, it depends on who we need to interview as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Thomas. You took us on your journey and it was a really fun ride. So we started up with getting into design because of the basically universality of it, as you said, and I can relate with that. I can also relate with your path. I also started as a purely visual designer and almost there when it comes to strategy. So yeah, it's a fun ride. Also, we touched upon the diversity topic, which is really important. And yeah, thanks for sharing your journey, your comfort zone, and your points of breaking those comfort zones. Anything more to add or to ask, Jorn?
I'm actually interested in how you two guys know each other, because that's also part of the non-work stuff. Like, how do you, as a non-Dutch person, what do you do outside of your work hours? How do you meet other people? How do you connect? What do you do?
You want this one, Philippe, or?
Please take it away. People are here to listen to you, not to me, Thomas.
Okay. That's a big assumption on your part, mate. If they tune in weekly, it might be because of you. Okay, what happened is booking.com had a basketball group and it used to just be over email, right? And only booking employees had access to this email address. And there was a guy who ran it. And all the employees, almost all internationals, would email every week and coordinate a time that go play on the weekends. And that group expanded to WhatsApp. And that obviously lowered the barrier for entry into that group. And all of a sudden, we started to get a lot of externals coming in, usually internationals. And Philippe was one of those people. He had met one of our guys on the court playing some street ball, and he was added to the WhatsApp group. And then, you know, we'd played together a few times and never really spoke. And then one day it turns out, hey, we're both designers. He's from Macedonia. And my family's background is Montenegrin, so there's also a connection there. Yeah, so there was a lot in common there.
Yeah, it was a really fun surprise. Yeah, we were chatting one day, and I was actually expecting that he's an engineer, because most of the guys there were engineers. And yeah, we got into chatting, and hey, guess what? We're both UX designers, and then we kick it off even better than before. The UX connection really works also on the court, right, Thomas?
It does, man. Look, there's something about magical about being a designer. I mean, I've seen developers meet, and they kind of connect a little bit, and you know, whatever. But there's so many different kinds of code and so many different kinds of things you can do as a developer, whereas design is design. You know what I mean? And it is a mindset. And when you meet other designers, there's a certain, I think, unity under the surface between all designers that no other profession that I can think of really has. And there's a magic to that. So when you meet someone like Philippe and you know, on a court, and you're both designers and you both love basketball, for example, you don't even need the basketball bit really, but it helps. There's just something magical there.
And it's still there, right? The group, the basketball group. You still manage it.
It's growing. It's still there. It's growing. It's now, you know, 100 plus people, and we're getting 30 regularly. But I mean, it's, you know, mostly internationals, mostly really good guys, good culture. And it's all these people who are away from home and have connected over something. And that something is basketball. And it's again, magical to see what happens, because if they were back home, it may not have that sort of culture.
Magical is not an overstatement, I must say here, because there is really good chemistry and energy there. Like Thomas said, a lot of expats who are finding their way in the city, and basketball connects them. And yeah, I have to compliment on that one, because he is the NBA commissioner of Amsterdam, actually. He's the facilitator of the group. So thanks for that, buddy. A moment of public gratitude for that.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah. Thank you. But, you know,
much appreciated.
As with anything, it's the people that make it special. So,
exactly.
I have one final question, and it's the one that gets asked in every interview, I think. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Do you still see yourself in the Netherlands? Do you still see yourself in Europe? Are you back in Australia?
I'll still be in the Netherlands. I'll still be here, and maybe even speaking Dutch by that time. But I can't recommend the place enough for many, many reasons. It's a wonderful place, and I highly recommend people consider moving here. You know, there was a podcast last week, and they were talking about kind of the whole remote working thing and the third shift in Silicon Valley, how people, you know, the Valley might actually not be the Valley anymore, basically, mm-hmm. because things are getting decentralized. And Amsterdam was mentioned as a hub, you know, a hub for Europe, or if not a hub, the hub. And I totally get why. We have the infrastructure, we have the language, we have the location, we have the mindset. It's also, if you've been here, there's a lot of wonderful architecture. There's a certain artistic mindset to the Dutch culture as well. It's not really pronounced, but it is there. And it's a wonderful place, man. I don't plan on leaving.
Thanks.
great words to end with. Thanks a lot, Thomas. Thanks a lot for the great conversation. And see you and speak to you soon. Hopefully they lift the ban and we can play some ball together soon.
Oh, yes, man. Thank you, guys. It's been nice talking. Thank you.
Hey there. Wait. Before you go, please give us your feedback on this episode and the entire series on hello@designawaypodcast.com. We would love to hear your thoughts so we can improve the future episodes. Thanks for listening, and have a good day.